Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline won't be able to join us today. But we have a subject that's really close to my heart today, a topic because I have been not exactly to the place that our guest has written about, but very close or a very similar place a few years ago. So we have with us today Helen Benedict, author of The Good Deed. And Helen is a professor at Columbia University, and she's been writing about refugees and war for many years, both in her nonfiction, Map of Hope and Sorrow, Stories of Refugees Trapped in Greece, which was published in 2022, and her two most recent novels, Wolf Season and Sand Queen. Helen is a recipient of the 2021 Penn Jean Stein Grant for Literary Oral History and the Ida B. Wells Award for Bravery in Journalism and the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism for her exposure of sexual predation in the military. She's also the author of The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women at War Serving in Iraq. Her writings inspired a class action suit against the Pentagon on behalf of those sexually assaulted in the military and the 2012 Oscar-nominated documentary, The Invisible War. And this book is called The Good Deed, and this is a novel about refugees in Greece. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Helen.
Thank you very much.
Now, The Good Deed is set on the island of Samos.
Samos.
And I visited the island of Lesbos.
Yes.
Which I think, I mean, from the descriptions, it's very, very similar.
Yes. Lesbos is the more well-known island because it has the more well-known refugee camp called Myra. I went to Samos because it also has a terrible refugee camp there, but that's not where everybody was going, and that's not the one that people knew about, even though... although it was smaller, it was actually worse in many ways. And at one point, it really was the most awful refugee camp in the whole of Europe, most overcrowded and underserved.
Wow. Now, I was there in, I believe it was the spring of either 2018 or 2019. And when was this written? What was this written about? And when were you there?
Yes. Well, I was there for the first time in 2018, and that's when the novel is set. So okay. It overlaps with your visit completely. So this is some years after the first rush of Syrians out of Syria in 2015 in reaction to the civil war there. And that's the era that most people know about. What they don't know is that Syrians and Afghans and Iraqis and people from many different countries in Africa has still been streaming out to escape war and conflict and persecution of different kinds and getting trapped on these islands in Greece because of the policies of the Greek government and the EU. and all of those, that trapping actually started in 2016. So with that, rose up more anti-refugee and anti-immigrant feeling, partly because of a new government that came into Greece in 2019. And so a very anti-immigrant government. So in many ways, when you and I were there, even though the world had turned its eyes away, it was worse.
Yes, yes. And when I was there, they weren't coming in at the same pace that they had been, but there were still people coming in. I met some of the people in this one little fishing village that would go out and rescue people from the water. And I met a man who would take the abandoned life vests and make bracelets out of them and was selling them online to try and raise money for the refugees. And, you know, there were a lot of Greek people who were really doing their best to be hospitable and trying to help. But it was such and you portray this very well in this book, that it's not that the Greeks are so horrible in their treatment of the refugees, but these islands were, in a sense, overrun. And tourists quit coming. It destroyed the livelihood of many of the people on the islands.
You see, I'm going to have to push back here because that's actually not quite true.
Well, it was from my experience.
If I may explain for a minute. This is what was said. This is what the Greeks claimed. But actually, yes, so in the island of Samos, all the refugees were put in this one camp near the town of Vathi. And it was a very small town, 7,000 people or so, and there were up to 8,000 refugees at one point. But the rest of the island didn't even, the tourists who came to the rest of the island, and usually they went to the other end of the island, did not even know the refugee camp was there. The reason the tourism dwindled was not because of the refugees. It was because, and I did some real research into this, taking off my novelist cap and putting on my journalist's cap, because most of the tourists are brought over by package companies, you know, who sail them on ships and put...
Right,
and
right.
And the package companies work by fads, you know, and so for a while Samos was a fad and then it wasn't a fad and they started going to different places, but also because of the economy, you know, there was the terrible economic crisis that hit Greece and so made it less attractive. So there was a lot of unfair blaming about tourism and refugees, at least on the island of Samos.
Well, I could see that, but I will say that there certainly were people on the island of Lesbos working to try and help the refugees. And also there were very few tourists there. I was there in May. It should have been a pretty good time in the hotel, the resort that I stayed at. It was probably 10% occupied at most.
Yes. Well, this is because, as I said earlier, everyone knew about Lesbos. So there, I think it was a different situation.
Yeah,
but people didn't know about Samos. And as I said, I had a piece in the New York Times about going to Samos as a beautiful destination. And by the way, if you want to give back, you can do this and this and this to help the refugees there. And I got so many letters from people who'd been going to Samos for years and were still going and had no idea that there was a refugee camp there.
So the
people of the town may have felt somewhat overwhelmed, but the island as a whole did not. And there's one other thing. The refugees spend a lot of money at the local shops because they've got to buy food, they've got to buy camping equipment. When they get money, the money goes into the economy. So that's another thing that isn't mentioned a lot. But I watched this with my own eyes, you know. So
yeah. I didn't see the kind of the discrimination against the refugees by the cafes and stuff that are in your book. That doesn't mean it wasn't happening. It may have just been like there was one time where my friend whose family was Greek and who set up this art program in the camps and that I went and helped with. And we were meeting with a young man, and they in a cafe, and there wasn't any issue, but it might've been cause he was with us. You know, I don't know what it would have been like for him if he'd been by himself.
Yeah. Well, I did go back about five times and, you know, I spent a lot of time there over the years and things changed. There's certainly in 2015, when people first started coming to the island, there was a lot of welcoming and kindness on the part of the local, Samians, as they're called. But as time went on and the government got harsher and the rules would change, trapping people there, not, you know, originally people would just pass through for a couple of weeks on their way to the mainland. By the time I went and later on, like by about 2022, when I went back to even 2019, people were trapped there for years.
Oh, wow.
years waiting for their asylum interviews, 3 years, 4 years. So local feeling had changed quite a lot, and a lot of hostility had risen. And it was a very different atmosphere. And I watched a really very shockingly overt racism happening. Again, not from everyone. There were kind, welcoming cafes, and then there were the cafes you knew not to go to, kind of thing.
Oh,
And the
wow.
same with
Wow.
shops. Some shops were welcoming and kind, and some shops wouldn't even serve refugees. I watched,
Wow.
turn them away, slam the door in their faces. I watched that too.
Oh my
So,
gosh. So what is the situation like now? Are those camps still open? Are there still people
no.
coming, or what has
There are
happened?
still people coming, but now what Greece did with money from the EU is they built a prison in the middle of the island, far away from any town or village or shop or hospital or cafe or anything, in the middle of nowhere, a closed prison, a detention center. And they closed down the camp that I wrote about. And now when you arrive, that's where you get put. It's closed circuit TV. You have to wear a bracelet, high surveillance all the time. You are watched. There are cameras everywhere, that are monitored from Athens. So basically, and this is considered a model, and they have been built four other such prisons on other Greek islands. And so the people who arrive, they can't walk around town or go swimming or sit in the sun in the same way they used to. They have to stay inside the walls of this. I went to see it. It's really ghastly. It looks like a high security prison, only with a big yard in the middle. No trees, no flowers, really, really barren. And there are children and women and in there, and it's really dire.
Are they still coming on these boats, overcrowded boats, and are
Yes.
people still drowning? And why
Yes.
are we not hearing about this anymore?
I think, the world's been distracted by Ukraine and Gaza for good reasons.
Yeah,
There have
yeah.
been these other wars and conflicts, Sudan, perhaps, by the world, I mean the media got tired of this story, but actually there have been a few stories, and one of the biggest scandals that's come out of Greece lately is that the Coast Guard of both Greece and the EU's Coast Guard, which is called Frontex, have been caught, instead of rescuing people from boats, pushing them back out to sea. Yeah, this has been well documented at this point. So they're pushing them back. Sometimes they're even putting them on rafts, and once they've landed, and pushing them back out to sea. So the number of drownings is shockingly high. And there are lots of people coming, and they're going to be more, but because of what's happening, Palestine and other countries, and also because of climate warming. So they're going to be a whole, there's going to be more and more climate refugees as well, trying to get to a cooler, more prosperous lands of northern and eastern, Western Europe. So it's a, we really have to find more humane ways of welcoming and helping people, because this is not an issue that's going to go away.
Wow. I mean, we could, I'd love to talk about your solutions, but let's talk about your book first.
Yes, let's get to the novel.
Yes, to the novel. So, what attracted you, or what made you decide to write a novel about the Greek refugee camps?
Yeah. I actually went there originally to research the novel, not to do nonfiction, because I had been writing novels about Iraqi refugees. The reason that I like to do it in fiction, not only nonfiction, is because I feel I can get deeper into people's hearts with fiction, and I don't have to put any actual person at risk or feel that I'm exploiting someone for their story, because none of the people are actual people. But I would never do a novel like this without a lot of research first. But when I got to the island and I saw how dire things were, I felt I also needed to do nonfiction, so because I just wanted the world to know more about what was going on. But the fiction is because I wanted to get deep inside what it feels like to be forced away from your home, what it feels like to live as a stranger in a land that's hostile to you, what it's like from moment to moment to live in a refugee camp, and the ways people find the ways they find comfort and sustenance and friendship and love. I wanted to write about the way human beings survive hardship, which I find very moving.
It is very moving. Now, when you have three main, well, four main refugee characters.
Yes.
And all women.
Yes.
And then one American tourist.
Yes.
Who's there. And one main Greek character
right.
as well. So you really let each of the refugee characters tell their story, tell their own story. So what I'm curious about is, you said none of them are real people,
right.
but like how close to real, to someone whom you interviewed. Is each of these based on the story of someone you interviewed, or they?
No.
Okay.
So I never do that in the fiction. I don't like take a real story and just thinly disguise it. But what I do is take all I've learned from listening to many people over the years, and create a story that's entirely possible and plausible and realistic. But it's not based on any one person's stories. There might be bits and pieces of different people's stories, along with things I've invented, or things I've seen, you know, or things I've heard about, all kind of mixed together. But I felt after years of listening to people that I could enter into their lives and become like them. And I also became very close friends with a young Syrian man who I met at the camp the first year I went, who co-authored my nonfiction book with me. And he read this book. He read The Good Deed to make sure that I had the Syrian parts in Syria right and the parts of the details of living in the camp right and the Arabic right and being a Muslim and things like that, but I'm not. So he was enormously helpful. I've dedicated the book to him, Iyad Awadonan. He's just a wonderful person. But yeah, so nobody's, you know, verbatim real, but they could be. They could be.
Now, each of the stories is tragic.
Yes.
And when you're doing the research and talking to people, how can you listen to these stories and not be overwhelmed by how tragic they are?
Well, I am overwhelmed sometimes. But the thing is, when even as we talk, we're also joking, we're also laughing, we're eating, we're taking walks, we're just being human beings in everyday life. And, you know, and I'm always feeling, as I said, so moved by the way people can survive these things and still be generous to each other, still make real friendships. I mean, part of the theme of this novel is the deep friendships between these women. And the way I originally conceived of it, which is sort of still stayed, is that after breakfast every morning, they climb the mountain behind the camp and they sit down and they tell each other their stories. And that's the construct of how the stories come out. So it's also about the friendships between women as well as between mothers and children. That's a big part of it as well.
Right.
There's a big theme also for the tourist, mother and child, and also grandmothers and grandchildren. All of that is also in there. So I suppose the comfort is that it's just the nobility of some human spirits and the determination to carry on no matter what. Amazing.
And do you ever get, like, you meet someone and you hear their story and you just want to try and save that person?
Oh, yeah.
And what do you do?
Well, of course, you can't.
Yeah.
It's also, I mean, that's sort of a big theme of the novel, is the arrogance of thinking you can save people. And that's the great mistake that the tourist, Hilma, makes. That's the good deed. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't all try to help. But, people have to save themselves. We can help them do it. I mean, sometimes it's just a matter of a few dollars between, life and death, or prison or not prison, or starvation or not starvation. I mean, it can take very little to help, but that's not quite the same thing as saving. But the urge to help, or help people find ways to save themselves, but to open some doors that are closed to them. Whatever we can do from our position of privilege is, of course, really important.
I know sometimes I just think about, like, I live alone. I have a big house. I could, in theory, open it up to somebody, but then that's a very, that would change my life completely. And yet I feel somewhat guilty for not being willing to do that. Do you ever feel guilt about not doing more?
I think anybody who has the urge, anyone who has compassion for people who are less fortunate than them and has an urge to help, always feels that they can't do enough.
Yeah.
Then even if you're doing a whole lot, you still feel like you can't do enough. You have to learn to live with that feeling, that to accept that there's only so much an individual can do. Now, some people devote their whole lives to this. Some people just do it part time. Some people, it depends who you are and what your circumstances are. But we just do our best. I think the one thing we shouldn't do is nothing.
I like that. Yeah. I like that. Everyone always, like when we read The Diary of Anne Frank or we read about the Holocaust, and everybody that I ever knew would be like, well, I would have helped. Mm-hmm. I would have hidden these people. I would have helped them. And yet, in a way, we have just people in just as dire circumstances now, that we kind of just look away. A lot of us just look away. But a lot of times, even people who are anti-immigrant in theory would help an individual if they met them. If someone showed up on their doorstep, they would help them.
Yeah.
Even while they're saying, don't let them in.
Right.
Yeah,
because an individual, a real human being in front of you, is different, than a stereotype,
right?
Or a mass of numbers.
And of course, there are refugees, immigrants who aren't good people, and who we don't want to let in a sense. And you have one of them, and you have a character in The Good Deed that like that, but that doesn't mean nobody should be allowed.
Well, I want to point out two things. One is, of course, people who are forced out of their countries are just people with an array of different qualities like any of us. But the other thing is that, statistically speaking, immigrants and refugees commit far fewer crimes compared to, native populations. And so this has been hugely exaggerated. And that's true in Europe and in the US. But I will say something from my own experience. I do think the kind of person who has the gumption to leave home, which is incredibly difficult to do, we all imagine doing it, leave your family, leave your house, leave your town, leave your culture, leave any kind of way you've come to matter to anybody, and become an absolute nobody in a completely different place. Anyone who has the gumption to do that and take a really dangerous journey on the way is quite a special person.
Absolutely.
It takes a kind of integrity. So I've actually found all the refugees and asylum seekers I've met to be extraordinary people, really extraordinary people.
So in the good deed,
yes,
you have this tourist whose name is
Hilma.
Hilma,
right.
And she comes to Greece kind of to escape a tragedy in her life.
Right.
And where, you know, the concept of, you know, how did you come up with the idea of, instead of just writing about the people in the camps, you know, having this story kind of over the underlying story, Hilma's story behind it?
Well, when I was preparing to go to Samos for the first time, I was going by myself, and I love swimming, so I was really looking forward to swimming. But at the same time, I was reading about all these people drowning off of boats in the northern Aegean. And I got this terror that I would be out swimming one day and I'd find a dead body of a refugee. I just got this idea in my head. And it wasn't enough to make me not go or not go swimming or anything. But that was the seed of the idea that started. I took that fear and turned it into a story.
Well, and so when you first went to Samos, you said you went to research for a novel. You knew you were going to write a novel about this.
I wanted to find out mainly what it was like living in the camp from day to day, moment to moment. How did people survive in a refugee camp?
Now, were you able to actually go into the camp?
I was. I went in once officially. I had to apply for permission from the government, and 3 months before I went, it was all very official. I was a guided tour. It was very controlled, and I had to promise not to write about it. They don't let journalists in.
Oh.
A promise I've clearly broken because I don't believe in being censored like that. And why are they not allowing people to write about it? What are they hiding? Because what they're hiding is a horrible camp run by, you know, really badly and unnecessarily cruel. So it had to be exposed. After that, I couldn't go in officially, but it's very porous. There's no locked gates, and there are guards. So people, the refugees I met, you know, they just say, put on a hijab or put on a long sleeve shirt, carry a plastic bag, and you'll look just like us. And so I just walked in that way, kind of undercover.
And one of the places, like right outside the camp, where the little school, the building where they had poetry classes and art
yes.
classes and so forth. So there was one of those on
yes,
Lesbos
that was
too.
All completely real.
Yes.
That was called Alpha Center, and it was run by Samos Volunteers, which was the first NGO there and the main one, and it's still there. It's still working with them outside of the prison. All the other NGOs have been pretty much kicked out by the government. But,
so I'm looking
but
at
that was all completely real, yes.
I'm looking at pictures that I took of the one on Lesbos,
yeah.
And it's basically kind of almost a little more than a tent in a way. It's got particle board walls,
yeah.
And it wasn't a real a real sturdy structure, put it that way. But like I said, we went there. We were doing a jewelry making thing. We brought all these beads and stuff, and mostly it was women and children that were there with us. And oh my, they loved it. You know, it was something to do. It was something different. It was, you know.
Well, that's one of the awful things about living in a camp is you're not allowed to work. There's no school for the children. So there's nothing to do except sit around and worry about your future and whether you'll get asylum or not. It's really the most awful feeling. And the majority of people there are young who should be in high school or college. So there's this feeling of being trapped with nothing to do is very bad for the spirit. So any kind of classes or also this place was actually in a real building in town, and they would hire asylum seekers to work as volunteers there and teach, because they, lots of people have amazing skills, you know. They would teach languages, they would teach whatever their skills were, sports classes, music classes, weaving, sewing, whatever it was. Most of the people there were men, but they did have classes for women and children in the basement, and some classes that were mixed, depending on whether people felt comfortable being mixed or not.
One of the, if I recall, one of the, there was a young man who my friend was helping. I think he was Syrian, and he had been there as an unaccompanied minor. You know, he was in the camp as an unaccompanied minor, but he was about to turn 18, and that was actually a very dangerous time, because he would lose some of the protections that he had as an unaccompanied minor. And I can't imagine just being 18 and being completely on your own without anybody looking out for you in that circumstance.
It happens to a lot of people.
So, Helen, why don't you read a little bit from The Good Deed for us?
Sure. Well, I'll read from the beginning, as we were just talking about this. This is just a few pages in. This is when Hilma has she's staying on Samos, as Monica said, to escape her own family tragedy and try and recover. So she's there to kind of recuperate on this beautiful island. It is very beautiful. And she decides to go swimming one morning. The sea is choppy this morning, last night having delivered the most brutal storm I've witnessed yet on Samos. The wind yowling and hammering at my shutters like a banshee, the waves sucking in great breaths and spitting them out again with a crash against the pebbled shore. But the air is already heating back up to its July highs, so in I wade, battling the surf, and after an initial flinch at the cold, head out to deeper waters, where it looks calmer. How I love the weightlessness of swimming, the exhilaration of cutting unfettered through the waves. Water crystalline and clean, those wagging fish, the sun projecting a light show on the seafloor, a spangling honeycomb of hexagons dancing over the sand, the brown seagrass rippling in the current like a field of wheat in the wind. I lose all sense of time and fly through the water as though it's as yielding as air. A splash dives into my snorkel tube, so I raise my head to empty the water out and take in where I am. Far, a great deal farther than I thought. I'm not tired, but I am sensible. Time to turn back. Just as I do, my eye catches a spot of colour, an orange object bobbing a short distance away. A buoy, perhaps, or else a polluting plastic bag I feel obliged to remove. I swim closer. It is not a buoy or a bag. It's a life jacket with somebody in it, a pitifully small somebody. A fist closes around me, pulling me to a halt, my breath suddenly short and airless. Not again, please. The little figure is ominously still, no sign of swimming or flailing, no movement at all. The fist grips tighter. Not this time, Hilma, you can't. With an effort, I wrench free of my paralysis and push myself closer. Then again, the fist. The water, too, is resisting me now, no longer as yielding as air, but viscous and stubborn as though I'm swimming through glue. I look around for a rescue boat. There is no rescue boat, no sign of anything but the endless azure, the ropes of waves and spume of whitecaps, a sea as wide as the earth. Fighting away the fist, I force myself to keep swimming. I've lost all my weightlessness now. I'm as heavy as cement. Be alive, please. When I'm close enough to call out, I spit away the snorkel. Hello? My words feeble against the great seethe of the sea. Hello? No response. Yasu, I try in Greek. Hello? Nothing. I swim closer, able to see the figure's face now, a tiny oval under a long tangle of wet black hair. A girl, a very little girl. Her eyes are closed, lips grey. She hangs suspended in the life jacket like a collapsed marionette. Then begins a macabre chase like something out of a fever dream, because the nearer I draw to her, the more the waves caused by my strokes push her away. Again and again I reach for her life jacket, only to send it spinning beyond my grasp. So I speed up and circle her like a shark, spiraling in closer and closer, the fist still trying to stop me, still trying to drag me away. Again I make a grab for her. Again I miss. I dive underneath her instead. Her legs dangle as limp as seaweed, swaying in the current. Chubby little girl legs, pink leggings, bare feet as pale as the underbelly of a fish. Oh God, please. Coming up beneath the life jacket, lungs ragged, I reach out yet again, trembling so violently I can barely control my hand. This time, though, I manage to grasp hold of a strap, pull her to me. Please, please, be alive. And now I'm just going to read a little bit from Amina's chapter. She's the Syrian, the main Syrian protagonist who's living in the camp. Just a little snippet of her voice. Down in the town here, old men sit in their cafes, smoking cigarettes, playing dominoes, dice or cards, drinking ouzo or metaxa, coffee or sugar-laced tea. Talk and braggadocio, grizzle and gristle, legs spread to display the dangling insistence of testicles. Women swing past, lips glossed, shopping bags heavy, hair dyed a rusty red, their children sleek and flat, careening by on bicycles, sucking on ice creams. Tourists come and go under sun hats and sunglasses, snapping photos, applying lotions, spending money. We, on the other hand, stay high up on the hill in a metal box, packed onto rows of bunk beds with 34 other people, like rows of carpet on a merchant's shelf. Rolls of carpet. Layla found us two bunks in a back corner, she and I on the lower levels, her sons Hazem and Majid, boys as small and sharp as thorns, above, our only privacy the grey blankets we hang around our bed frames and the clothes we use to cover our bodies. Inside these, we pretend to have a home. Sometimes we look down at ourselves, shocked at how this place has changed us. Layla, a widow of not even 40, has grown bloated from the foul air and food here. Her face as pale as wheat, hair greased for want of water. Our friend Nafisa, who sleeps alone in a tent outside, is not much older, but with her skin ashy and cheeks sunken could pass for 80. As for me, I am only 19, yet since I lost Mama and all I knew, I feel as old as the moon.
Thank you. And that was Helen Benedict reading from her novel, The Good Deed. So did you do the writing while you were there or after you returned home? And where is home for you?
I live in New York, New York City, very different than Ireland and Greece. Yeah, both. I did start writing it there because I wanted to capture the colors and the sound, and you know, I just wrote every day, everything that had happened to me, everything I'd seen, but I didn't start creating the characters till I got home, so it was more the descriptive stuff that I wrote there and the interviews I was doing.
And you said, and then you, even though you originally intended to just write the fiction book, you wrote the nonfiction book first.
I actually wrote this first.
You wrote this first. Okay.
I wrote this first. And then because of COVID, it was put on hold by the publisher. And then while I was waiting, I got an invitation to go back to Samos with a photographer to do an article. And we decided to work with my Syrian friend as the translator. And we were going to go do journalism. And we had it all set up, and then March 2020, you know, boom, we couldn't go anywhere. So I realized that then that I had all these interviews I hadn't used, and Iyad was living there, and he could talk to people person to person who were his his fellow refugees in the camp, and I could use WhatsApp to interview other people who could speak English or French. So we did a lot of our research during COVID for the nonfiction, and that ended up coming out first, even though it was written second.
Did COVID hit the camps?
It did, but not as badly as everyone expected. I thought it would be a disaster because everyone's living on top of each other.
Yeah.
But they're living outside
almost
all the time. Also, I should say another reason it was easy for me to meet people and see how they lived is because the camp itself is really tiny, and so because there was it was actually built for under 700 people, and there were 8,000 people there at one point. So people were living in tents and homemade shacks all over the hills around the camp, you know, that you could just go to. And I visited people and had tea with them and stuff in their homes. So they did have a kind of quarantine place where they put people with COVID and very stupidly put the families with them, even if they weren't sick.
Oh.
Yeah, it's like a leper's colony. So those people got sick. But actually, mostly it was carried, when it did happen, it was carried in by the workers from the villages, and from the Greek workers would carry it in. So it wasn't terrible. It happened, but it wasn't terrible. And also the rules were very strict about masks. Mm. You got fined, I think it was 300 euros if you were caught outside without a mask, which was more money than most of the refugees could hope to see in many, many, many months.
What about, did they have access to vaccines early?
When they came, yes.
Yeah, that's good.
Yes.
I'm sure that saved a lot of lives.
Yes. Yeah. There were some deaths, but it was surprisingly not as terrible as...
Okay, so you wrote the nonfiction book, and did you have any difficulty finding a publisher for that?
No, I got a few offers, but I took the one in England. There's this wonderful press called Footnote, which is devoted to writing about people living marginalized lives.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, had no idea there was a press devoted to that. That's wonderful.
It's you.
That's
Mine wonderful. Was their very first book.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Now, The Good Deed is published by Red Hen Press.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about them. I've done a number of books from Red Hen.
Yeah, they're great. So they're based in California. They've been around for about 25 years. And they're becoming a very big independent press. They have a poetry division. They have an LGBTQ division. They do novels, nonfiction, all kinds of things. And, you know, it's a sort of a family enterprise that's spread now, and it's getting bigger and bigger. I think they're doing very well.
And had you published with them previously?
No, this is my first book with them, but they are doing a second novel of mine in 2026.
Now, how many novels have you published?
This is The Good Deed is my eighth novel.
Your eighth novel. And now your bio said you're a professor at Columbia. Are you a professor of journalism?
I am. I'm in the Graduate School of Journalism. Yes.
Okay.
That's my other side. My other
So you've all along written both, you know, done both journalistic writing and fiction writing?
Yes.
From like the very beginning, or was there a point in time where, you know, you were only doing one and then decided, hey, I miss the other and I want to do the other two? Or how
well,
did
your journey?
I don't
do them simultaneously. That's too hard. So I've actually written more novels than I have nonfiction books, but I've written hundreds of articles over the years. So I started off working on newspapers, so then I was full-time doing a full-time journalism. But whenever I could, I was always trying to write novels because that was my first love. I mean, I started writing fiction when I was 8. That was always my great dream.
So how many novels did you write and stick in the drawer before you actually started publishing?
I would say, well, one.
One?
Yeah, I mean, it went
Yeah.
through a lot of iterations, but it's
Yes.
basically the same novel. That one never went anywhere. It was in a drawer. So
Yeah.
the first one I published was really the second one I wrote.
And what was it about?
That was called A World Like This, and it was set in a girls' prison in England, a prison for adolescent girls, which was a real place that I'd worked in for a while.
So are all your novels contemporary fiction?
No, there's one set in the Seychelles where I lived as a child, which is set in 1960. And there's another one set in Greece. Actually, my first novel about Greece is called The Sailor's Wife. It's set in another northern Aegean island called Limnos, and that's set in 1975, just at the when the junta, the military junta that had controlled Greece, fell. And I'd been there then. It was a very dramatic time to be visiting. So those were both the kind of historical, but in the only, but still in the same century,
I know. It's
you
kind of sad when historical novels are set during our lifetime.
Exactly. But they weren't contemporary, so I'll put it that way.
Right. Now, do you have Greek heritage?
No.
No. So what drew you to Greece?
Like all Brits, one is starved for sunlight. So it was very, we all went beetled off to Greece as quickly as we could because it was hot, beautiful, and cheap. And nearby from England, it's very easy to get there. So I first went when I was, well, when I was a child, my parents would bring me there, but I first went on my own when the year I graduated from college, and then I hitchhiked around and with friends, even by myself, and did the sort of footloose and fancy free thing you do when you're 21 years old.
So how many times have you been to Greece? Would you
Ooh.
just estimate?
8, 9 times
Wow.
over my lifetime.
Would you go back?
Oh, sure. I mean, I love it. You know, I love it. I have trouble. I don't love the government there now. And I have trouble with the, you know, the really virulent anti-immigrant rhetoric that's risen a lot recently. It's not just in Greece,
Yeah.
but Greece is, I will say, of all the countries in Europe, it is the most cruel to refugees, and
Really?
that comes from Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and so on. This is
Wow.
not just my opinion.
Oh,
It is
wow.
the most cruel, and that certainly wasn't always the case, but it is a deliberate policy from the government.
Now, have the characters in The Good Deed
Yeah.
came to Greece from Turkey. They did have to spend some time in Turkey. Were you able to do any research in Turkey?
Yes, I actually have been to Izmir, which is the main town that they catch their boats from, because it's right on the southern coast. And there's a little town nearby where they get the boats. It's only 1.5 kilometers from Lesbos, from Samos. You could swim, and people have. You could swim across. That's how
Wow.
close it is. But because of the currents and the winds, and because these rubber boats they take, the dinghies, don't have rudders, it can take 6 hours, 8 hours, or 10 hours to cross because you get blown way off course and nobody can really control the boats. So it always looks really easy. You can see Turkey
Oh
from
yeah.
Samos all the time.
I could see Turkey from my hotel in Lesbos. Yeah.
Yes, but it's much harder to cross than you'd think.
Well,
Yeah.
one thing I found interesting was the traffickers did not don't go on the boats,
Right.
and so the boats basically are one time use. What happens to them when they
Right.
land?
Or sometimes what I heard a lot is that they'll the trafficker will the smuggler will get on the boat just to get it away from the shore. And then jump out and swim back, will be picked up by a speedboat and abandon everybody.
Right.
Actually, one day I was taking a walk in the port in Vathy in Samos, and there were two rubber dinghies that had been pulled up onto the dock, half deflated, full of like deflated life jackets, plastic bags soaking wet, children's socks. You know, it was very, very hard. I took photographs because it said so much, these empty, deflated boats. And they're all patched up. I mean, these are terrible boats. You know, they're not seaworthy, even before people get overload them. It's just, it's criminal. There's so many people who take advantage of it,
And then
desperate.
somebody on the boat has to steer it.
Yes.
And do you want to, I learned something new about that. Do you want to explain
Yes,
that?
this is in the novel. So,
Yeah.
according to Greek law, if you steer a refugee boat, you can be charged with human trafficking as a smuggler, even if you're a refugee yourself when you're doing it, and so that you don't all drown. That actually happened to a friend of mine, and it happens all the time, and there are people serving years and years in prison who are just refugees steering their own boats. So it's a very cruel system.
So in the novel, some of the people, some of the refugees were aware of that and sort of
They
forced a
force this
young,
young boy who doesn't know to steer the boat, so he's the one who gets arrested. That's based on stories I heard.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow. What are some of the other sort of things that you put in the book that maybe surprised you to learn?
Yeah. It did surprise me when I found out that people had to queue up for 6 hours just to get breakfast or lunch. And then breakfast would be a miniature croissant and a miniature one of those little juice boxes like you buy for your kids' lunch. And very
Wow.
often, they would queue up for dinner, and by the time they got to the head of the line, the food had run out. A lot of the food was half rotten, so people were getting sick on it. So they tried to cook for themselves, and then the camp banned anybody from having cooking equipment in the containers. I mean, they were constantly in a kind of trap like this. They got a small allowance, which is what they would buy the food with, you know. So that shocked me. And another thing was looking at was the toilets. They only had very few like porta potties around. The containers had their own toilets, but and one for 34 people, you know. But people who were camping outside had no real sanitation facilities at all, and the toilets quickly became completely unusable. So it was that was very dire. A lot of the women told me that they were afraid to go out of their tents after dark, afraid to go to the toilet. They couldn't go alone. It was too dangerous. There's no protection for women. There's no protection for women who've already been raped on the way there. There's no protection even for a lot of the unaccompanied children. There's supposed to be, but there's one thing on paper and another thing in reality. And yet people, you know what really surprised me? Is everyone in the camp was so clean and well groomed. Their clothes were clean, their hair was clean. I mean, the children's clothes were sometimes raggedy, but they were clean. And all they had was some outdoor taps. But people, they held onto their dignity by washing their clothes by hand in cold water and wearing them until they dried,
Oh my
or
goodness.
draping them. It was laundry draped all over everywhere. And that, I just try, and it was such a filthy camp, garbage everywhere, mud, dust, rats everywhere. I mean, it was really disgusting, and yet people managed to keep well groomed. That was astonishing to me.
That is astonishing. And like you said, happy in some, I mean, obviously their circumstances are miserable, but they still find ways to find joy.
Joy and dignity, and yeah, working together, taking turns cooking and cleaning, cooperating, having tea. The number of people who invited me into their little tents and shacks and insisted on serving me tea, which is, a big thing in Arab and Muslim culture. It was very moving. So I have scenes like that throughout the novel. I don't want anyone to think it's all gloom and doom by any means,
Right,
you know.
right.
Plus,
Now,
the Greek guy is pretty funny.
Oh, he is.
Say it
He
myself.
is. And now tell us a little bit about Nafisa, because she came from Sudan, is it?
Yes.
And had been an immigrant in Europe. And how does she end up back on this Greek island?
Yes, well, that's it's a long story which she tells, but yes, she manages to get herself and her daughter out of the Ethiopian camp where they were living for several years, having fled the war in Sudan. And she tells her story to Western journalists, and that's how, and then people start donating, and that's how she gets sponsored to get out. And she gets settled in Sofia, the capital city of Bulgaria, which is a very, very cheap place with almost no refugees in it. I've been there, but I did find out about that. And that she's there, and they live there for quite a long time until her daughter's a teenager, and they're managing okay. She's got a job, and the daughter's in school. And then the, but then, various terrorist attacks that happened in Europe happen, and that people, more and more hatred and vilification of refugees is growing all over Europe and the US. And as a result, more and more refugees are getting attacked, and that is actually what happened. And her daughter gets attacked, and Nafisa is so horrified that she does something I am not going to reveal because I don't want to be a
No,
spoiler, but she
no.
does something pretty dramatic, which means that she has to flee the country.
Yeah.
And that's how she ends up after a long time being a refugee again, this time in Greece.
And have you met someone who had a similar story to that at all, or?
I won't know, but I did hear a story about from a journalist friend who had interviewed women who had been, you know, gang raped and had their whole families killed in Sudan, and who wanted the world to know their stories, even though, and who had survived that. Can you imagine having all your children killed? And that's what inspired Nafisa's story for
Wow.
me, was that
Okay.
story,
Well,
that
Helen,
woman.
we're out of time, and I want to thank you for being with us today, talking about The Good Deed. It was, of course, a novel that I really enjoyed because it took me back to the time that I had spent on Lesbos. But even if you've never been to Greece, I think a reader would really get a lot from this book. And like you said, that even though there's a lot of tragedy, there's a lot of joy and hope as
Yeah,
well.
good.
Yeah.
Good.
So,
Well, it's out in April, April 9th.
that's great. And that's 2024, in case you're listening to this later, so you can look for it. The Good Deed by Helen Benedict. We always end with a quote, and I found this quote from a poem by Worsan Shire. No one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land. Thank you, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.